What's up, y'all? Summer's got a different tempo. Everything's a little looser, brighter. One plan turns into another. You hear something, you stay a little longer. Next thing you know, you're somewhere you didn't plan to be. It's those in-between moments. That's where the ideas hit. Conversations stretch out, little memories sneak up on you. And sometimes, it's just about what's in your hand. That color, that chill. The new Tropical Butterfly Refresher from Starbucks. Guava and passion fruit flavors with mango pineapple flavored pearls. Yeah, that feels like summer before you even taste it. Funny how one small stop becomes the best part of the day. Start your summer rhythm with Starbucks. Try the new Tropical Butterfly Refresher from Starbucks.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details. Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Drake.
We got a lot to talk about this morning. We are diving back into the Nancy Grace disappearance and where it's all at. There's been so many questions over the last 5 months now, which is what we are going on to, and not enough answers. One of the strangest things about the Nancy Guthrie case is how inconsistent the offender behavior appears. Whoever approached that house allegedly came prepared enough to conceal identity, carry a weapon, and interfere with surveillance equipment. But at the same time, the behavior around the ransom communications, the digital trail, the apparent lack of clean operational control feels a bit messy. This lane is about the contradiction at the center of the case. Are investigators dealing with someone highly organized or someone just organized enough to be dangerous? We're going to tackle that. Who this person might be, what sort of damage has been done to the case already, and what can be done moving forward in three different parts today. Jennifer Coffendaffer, retired FBI special agent, joining me to break all this down. Jen has been on this case from day one and over on Break the Case, your podcast and your YouTube channel. I know you have been so deep into this almost every single day, and I've really wanted to get back with you on that. And just kind of do a recap, kind of a reconvening here, where things are at right now and where they might be going. Let's just kind of go back towards the beginning. The suspect, as we know, allegedly understood enough to target a camera system. There was a camera there. We saw what he did with the greenery. Camera goes out. Apparently not, though, enough to understand the back end. Cloud recovery might still preserve footage. And there's been back and forth about that, and that seems to be the big piece everybody talks about because there's not enough other pieces to talk about. So let's talk about it. It's a weird middle ground. Does that suggest that this was somebody who was having some sort of technical familiarity with how the camera works, or somebody who's sophisticated, or somebody who grabbed some greenery and got rid of the camera? All of these 5 months in, Where do you sit on the interaction that the masked man had with Nancy's doorbell camera?
Well, when you look, and such a great question, when you look at this, the way he skulks up, and we know he was there on a prior date, or at least it would appear probably January 11th that he was there without his gun, without the backpack, different shoes, different shirt, and he's right up there on that porch, and so he definitely did some surveillance. he knows exactly where that camera is. He puts his head down. And as he approaches, I think it is clear that he has a mission, and that's to pull it off. But to your deeper question, so what's his technical capability? Did he think pulling off that camera would suffice without a subscription? And that is if we are to understand that he somehow is related enough to know there wasn't a subscription. Tony, I got to tell you that Sheriff Nanos and many others didn't think there was any way to get that coverage without a subscription. It's a minor miracle that Google and the FBI worked together to pull that on day 10. It really, really is. I don't know if people can really appreciate the millions and millions and millions of photos and video that would be written over and over and over again, like an onion. And the fact they were able to pull any of it. I thought this was really interesting when Kash Patel said very recently, a couple of days ago, that, geez, if we could have been pulled into the investigation on day one instead of day four, we could have maybe gotten more because, again, that onion was just being layered on top of. So I thought that was really interesting.
And I want to get into that in our second segment about the damage that may have been already done and some of the things that Kash has said. Let's talk about this a little bit more because I think there's still a lot of confusion as to understanding the camera itself and what it has caught over the course of time. I know there has been talk that did he show up two different times? Was there surveillance going on? Give us some insight here. Refresh me on this. Do we know for a fact that he did show up at two different dates and that we have two different images that we've seen from this camera that were not from the same evening that she disappeared?
So initially when I saw that, I thought it could have been the same night, but that he wasn't rigged up yet, geared up. Then as more and more information came in, I do believe it's a different night, and I do believe it's the 11th. Why do I think that? A couple of supporting factors. Number one, Savannah says that. She specifically put out a statement and says the 11th is important. The night of the 31st is important, which is also interesting. And then the other thing that is, to me, factual, what I can put my eyes on and say is different, appears to be the lighting. So on the first, when she was abducted, at that time frame, there was a full moon. The 11th, it was a waning crescent. So a sliverish of a moon, less lighting, and you can see that. In addition, I don't think he would have changed his shirt if you look closely, his shoes. You can take the backpack and not put the holster on, but I do think it's going to be likely a separate day.
If it was two nights and he did surveil and he looked at, okay, here's the entryway, what does that mean for the doorbell, though? I mean, it was the fact that he got there, had to turn it. Was this just a stupid, simple oversight? I know I'm still stuck on it, because if this was a two-night thing and he knew there's a doorbell there with a camera on it, wouldn't you be ready immediately to go right up to that thing and take it out? Not, oh yeah, shit, there's a doorbell. Let me turn around and grab some foliage. Again, unless I'm misinterpreting what the foliage even was to begin with. Was that not to cover it? Was that more of a gripping mechanism? I know we've talked about that as well.
Yeah, when I see it and watch the footage, it looks to me like he 100% knows it's there. He comes in with his head straight down like this and kind of skulks in there. And then he puts his hand over the camera, which is all you would need. You don't need shrubbery. That's going to cover it even less. Right? Not shrubbery. I shouldn't call it that. It's ivy. I believe it's ivy.
Yeah.
But he puts the foliage up. So he goes like this and something is happening. And if you look at his gloves, they are so big. They're wrinkled on his hands. And I think he possibly could have had another pair under. I'm unsure of that, but certainly the gloves don't fit. Mm-hmm. And I surmise that he went to grab that and he can't get a good grip because the gloves are so big. So he goes back. I don't think the foliage or the ivy is used as concealment. He's got his hand he can just put up there and pull it with the other hand. I think he's having a gripping problem. And part of the reason I believe that is if you look at the mechanism that actually held that camera, it has ivy that's on, like in it. In other words, ripped so hard that it's in the screws and in the mechanism that held. If you were just having it out here to cover, it would never need to touch that. So for some reason, I think he grabbed it with that IV. And I don't think he thought it would be so hard to grip and pull.
Yeah, it's almost like we've been almost misinterpreting the purpose of the IV to begin with, if that's what it was for. Let's talk about another element here. Obviously, it's been a big one because it continues to be, I think, it continues to make the most noise of everything, because when there's not a lot going on, any little noise that happens is big. And anybody could ring this bell if they so wanted to. I guess if you send an email to TMZ and say you want some money, you'll get some press. If the ransom was truly the objective, the victim selection itself feels a little bit strange. I mean, Nancy was elderly, medically vulnerable, had mobility limitations, and reportedly required medication. Operationally, that's an extremely high-maintenance victim. Does the victimology itself undermine this kidnapping-for-profit narrative? I mean, what's your thoughts here? Was this a kidnapping-for-profit? What are we thinking the motive was here now that we're 5 months in and have had some time to let some of the dust semi-settle?
Right. So I think it's twofold. I think it's 100% targeted. And I believe that this person, it's personal. So targeted, they want Nancy. They want the family to suffer. They want money. They want public humiliation. And they got it all. They did it all. They got what they wanted. So when you really add it all up, to me, that's all you can see, because there's no reason. I do believe this. I don't believe that they thought that she, and this is just what I believe, that she expired. I don't believe they thought they couldn't keep her alive long enough to do a demand.
Yeah.
So now she's dead. They have no proof of life. So what do? They're going to go to the media and make this big and make it embarrassing for the family. Because now the family, a lot of people believe they're losers for not saving their mom when they're worth $40 million, right? A lot of people are going after this family. It pisses me off, but it's happening. And it's because they put this out here on TMZ.
Yeah.
For millions to see. Why? Why do you do that when you know the family is going to be told by the FBI, don't pay it unless you have proof of life? And then they beg for proof of life. Then they pray for proof of death. You're right. They beg the people, and then they don't get any of it. So they don't give any money. And look at what people are saying. These people, when you ask if they're sophisticated, they're a dichotomy for sure. But you know what, Tony? They've accomplished exactly, I think, what they wanted to accomplish. The Guthrie family suffered, Nancy suffering, likely deceased. They got exactly what they wanted, and they haven't been caught by the FBI yet.
So was money ever a motivation? Do you think that was the original plan here and it just went horribly sideways and then they got really angry? Like, damn it, she died. Let's make the family suffer. I mean, it just seems so cartoon villain. I mean, where it's like, I want to make them suffer. That does exist. I mean, we've seen like Koberger and things like that. There's sadistic, horrible human beings out there. I guess they'd have to be that if we're going to go down that road of they're sitting in a corner and they really enjoy watching other people suffer. And I guess how much of the vehicle is that is driving whatever occurred here?
I think that's what's driving it. Yeah. I really do. And if you want a family to suffer, that's what you take away from them. You take away their money. If you can, they couldn't. You take away life. And you take away their positive prominence in the public's perception. And, you know, you have people pointing fingers at all the family members. I mean, basically, you have people. I saw a survey. Ridiculous. Millions of Americans believe Annie Guthrie and Tommaso are responsible for this.
I know. And it's people will dig into whatever bullshit and it's hard to get them out. It's a weird motivation for something like this. I mean, granted, so many cases are weird, but just to inflict pain on people, and that's the goal, I guess. Why? I mean, why Nancy? I mean, is this something where, and I'm wondering if there's another piece to this that we're not seeing that is in the hands of the authorities or in the hands of somebody. That is there a message that these people wanted to get out, or this person wanted to get out, and that has been delivered to a media outlet, but somebody has said, no, we're not going to put this message out there for you. Were they using this as a vehicle to get attention, is what I'm saying. They got their attention and thought, okay, now's the time. The stage is set. I can give my message. And they gave their message and they're like, nope, we're not going to publish that. That would make a little more sense than just, okay, we inflicted pain and damage and suffering and now we disappeared.
Well, how have they disappeared? You know, I keep asking this question. If you look at the first two ransom notes, clearly law enforcement believed them to be legitimate.
Yeah.
They had very particulars in them, what she was wearing, all of this, and they would not have orchestrated all of those, the conglomeration of the family coming together to reach out if they didn't believe in them. That's just facts. So
yeah,
believed it. And Savannah has said, I believe the first two are real. That's what she believes. And I think that's from the totality of what she knows from law enforcement. So if we're to believe the first two are real, remember there's six emails, I should call them. They're not letters, they're emails that went into the servers in two different local Tucson affiliates. When that didn't get the play 12 hours later, it goes to TMZ, which of course is going to get the play. They are huge. Yeah. You know, that's what they talk about. Celebrities, Savannah's a celebrity, and true crime. Mm-hmm. You mix that all together, it makes sense to go to TMZ. But not for money. That's not for money. That is for notoriety, control. Think of it as a person who sexually assaults somebody.
Yeah.
They have control of the whole dynamic. And how better way to get control than to send those letters out? But I followed up with this, Tony. You know, there's been about six other letters, including two that came the day Savannah returned.
Uh-huh.
Right? Returned to the set. And these other letters, nobody has said they're connected. Savannah didn't say these were connected. But riddle me this, same modus operandi, going to these media outlets, same Bitcoin, right? They want Bitcoin, not any other cryptocurrency that's named. They have a Bitcoin account set up. We know it's different than the first one. And look at the pain that's inflicted. Savannah goes back and they send two more. I'm just saying law enforcement doesn't know who the six emails are from, the first six. And they don't know who the letters are from. Mm-hmm. So how could you possibly say they're definitely not interrelated?
If those first emails were legit and there was information on them that only they knew, let's assume that that's what they are for a moment. Because I know there's been a lot of kerfuffle about that too, where it's, well, they could have figured this out by just doing some Googling, doing some AI work, and you can make something sound pretty real, even if it's not. But let's say that there was something there that we're not aware of that hasn't been published that, yeah, okay, this clearly has to be the person because only they would know this. Did the FBI give the bad advice? Was that bad advice to say don't pay it early on without proof of life? Now, obviously, you want the proof of life, but if you have such really solid info on this thing that really only they could know, there's coulda, shoulda, woulda, but was that the wrong advice in a situation like this?
Well, my thing is, what's the quid pro quo? You give, but what are you getting back? They disappear with the money? And, looking at this whole Bitcoin, and I mean, I was on a Bitcoin terror for about 3 weeks and had a specialist on that was so good. The bottom line is to say that that can't be traced is just not correct.
Then why hasn't it been?
What's that?
Then why hasn't it been?
Well, there's been no deposit made that's been withdrawn.
Okay.
There's $300, you know, just to see if it worked, I guess. Just, but nobody withdrew that $300. Why do you think nobody withdrew the $300? Because I think they're concerned, if I withdraw, could there have been something, a parameter put into place where I'm going to be traced? Does everybody get where I'm going with this? I mean, there are a lot of Bitcoin cases that have been solved. And the end user has been identified. That's why I keep saying, tickle the frickin' wire.
Well, at this point, would it even work? I mean, at this point, if they're still out there, they're watching us. They're watching everybody. They'd know. Well, clearly, at this point, if I withdraw this, they're going to figure out who I am. I mean, they'd have to find another method, I would think, to try and gain this money. I mean, if they were to suddenly drop, here's $100,000 in this wallet, it's a little more incentive to. Well, it's not worth $300 to see if they catch me, but $100,000, million, whatever it may, you want to drop into there, that may make somebody, you know, take a shot at it and see, can I get away with this? I guess, is that worth doing? Why hasn't the FBI done something like that to tickle the wire?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, it's not a certainty that the breadcrumb of the withdrawal would definitely mean victory. In other words, that they would definitely be exposed, right? There's all these things you can do with these Bitcoin accounts. And it's literally like back in the day when you did a money drop or when somebody robbed a bank and had the money and you're literally tracing, oh, that money was used at JCPenney's. Oh, that money was used for this. And it's a nightmare, but you finally, takes forever, but you can find how it comes out clean. You know, if enough of these breadcrumbs. So it would be a nightmare from what my understanding now is of Bitcoin because of all these different things. But, you know, you have to be able to make it liquid. Although I don't know if you knew this, but you can use Bitcoin in fast food places now.
Sure.
I mean, a lot of people believe it is our future, is this cryptocurrency.
Yeah.
For what that's worth. But what I mean is, who cares if you have $100,000 if you can't buy a car with it? So they need to be. So that's just my point. Why hasn't the FBI done it? I think they don't want to set a precedent. By the way, it's already been set abroad, just not here, that if you don't have proof of life, you pay. Right?
Sure.
Because they worry about other people doing that. So I totally understand that. I'm just saying, if you're at a dead end, I would be doing that.
Yeah.
If you're dead end.
Yeah. There's so many questions as to why is this happening? Why is this not happening? And yeah, I mean, I don't know. And I don't think anyone does. Your thoughts in the comments section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in. The links are in the description.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Drake.
At this point, the Nancy Guthrie case isn't just about what's happening at the house. It's about what happens after law enforcement arrived. The FBI director publicly criticized the handling of the case. Pima County pushed back. Evidence reportedly went through multiple channels. The public got conflicting narratives about access, timing, then forensic processing. In this section, in this lane, we're going to be talking about something investigators hate discussing publicly. Whether institutional friction may have damaged some of the case itself, and I think friction might be putting it nicely. Jennifer Coffendaffer, retired FBI special agent, with us to help break this down. Law enforcement agencies disagree privately all the time, but when an FBI director, now Cash, has come out and publicly implied critical evidence handling was delayed or mishandled, he did this on Sean Hannity's podcast. What does it tell you about the level of frustration behind the scenes here and just kind of the, I don't know, kind of callous, off the cuff kind of way it was delivered on the Sean Hannity podcast? I mean, it's just, it was, I don't know. I'm not surprised, and I'm not saying it was a bad thing that he said what he said. I think it was very kind of just forthcoming and raw about the case. But it certainly has implications as well. What are your thoughts?
Well, the director of the FBI.
Yeah.
I mean, this is really unprecedented. I've talked about the fact that directors are typically back in for decades, they were figureheads. They were not in the weeds of investigations. That was trickled down to the assistant directors and then down, of course, to the field agents. Remember, it's the field agents that really have most of the power. They're the ones actually working the cases and making the day-to-day decisions. So to see a director point this out, I thought was huge. I mean, it is the biggest slap in the face that I've probably seen ever in any case when you have a director point that kind of finger. And really not even that veiled, Tony, give the implication, like about the DNA and about the issues. You know, I always say this, when you have cracks at the top, you're going to have cracks in an investigation. Having said that, I truly believe the boots on the ground are working well together.
Yeah, I mean, that's, I'm sure there's great investigative work that is going on behind the scenes here. It's just your figureheads are not the greatest, it seems, on this. I mean, when Cash speaks about this, it makes you go, okay, well, he's not the greatest at decorum to begin with. I mean, is this, is he speaking out of turn? Was that speaking out of turn to say something like that, in your opinion? Was that a wise move to, and I'm not trying to make this a let's criticize Cash Patel segment, but I don't know. Was that a good move? Was it? Is that level of transparency something that is a nice change, and we should have more of that? Or is that someone who really just doesn't quite know the ropes and the cause and effect of speaking out in that sort of way, and someone who really wants to be a field agent and really has no true FBI experience, but is now suddenly the director of it and doesn't quite know his role and the cause and effect of the words that come out of his mouth?
Well, I think if you look at what he promised Trump, he said, listen, I'm going to curb violent crime in cities. We're going to deport everyone we possibly can. And we are going to be transparent in terms of things we're doing, at least, you know, the things they decide they want to be transparent about. And he's transparent for sure on this case. I think it just depends on your lens. I mean, you're talking right now to a 25-year-old or a 25-year vet of an institution that I just thought so much of. And we did things so differently when I was in. We were so quiet. We just did our work. And in this new age of social media, and it's a whole different can of worms, I think.
How does that affect the operation of the investigation when things like this are being spoken about publicly? Maybe this is the new norm. Maybe this is how things are going to be going forward, whether it's Cash Patel or whoever is in that position. I don't know. Again, I'm not trying to make this a rip on Cash Patel segment. I'm just trying to understand the dynamics here of what's going on. And if this is how things are being handled now, is this for the better? That's kind of where I'm at. I don't know.
This is the new norm, I think. This is not going away unless they get somebody after Cash Patel. If they hire somebody like a Chris Swecker, who used to be number two, you know, AD over the entire criminal. If they get somebody like that, you're going to see it go back to more how it used to. He will certainly be, he's a great public speaker and he'll come out a little bit more. But, you know, he was considered for the job. If you have somebody like that, an old school that was an FBI agent for decades, or at least 10 years, I think, probably 10 years. I don't know. It was a long time. Maybe it was 2 decades. Anyway, nevertheless, you're going to see that. But this is a new age type person. Cash Patel, I mean, he came in. He said, I'm going to get rid of headquarters. He's getting rid of headquarters. I'm going to take everybody from there and I'm going to put him out in the field. I have to say, he's following through with everything he promised, and we're going to continue to see this. But wow, I think it could have a big effect if he's going to talk about different local offices in this way.
Well, it makes me wonder a little bit. And I'm trying to look at this, you know, with open eyes on every perspective of this and really kind of take personal opinion and things out of it. In a way, the way that he did call this out and basically, and I'm just kind of paraphrasing here, but talking about the first, you know, 4 days here, 72 hours of, if we had gotten a call earlier, we had resources. He said he had a plane ready to go. He had all these things that were ready to go, but they weren't, you know, launched because they weren't given permission locally to go in and assist. In a way, it kind of puts other departments on notice to a certain extent of, okay, if you think you can handle this and you really can't, let's be smart about this and let's call in the FBI and let's use the resources when we should and not, you know, think we can handle something that we can't. But at the same time, it also does state, you know, I wonder how different this case would be had they been called in sooner. Two different things, putting other departments on notice, it seems, and also at the same time, what could have been done differently? What do you think we would be sitting here talking about today had the FBI been involved from the first 24 hours?
Well, first, Tony, I do want to say this, is that when you're talking about a public official, which is exactly what Sheriff Nanos is, right? Uh-huh. As opposed to Kash Patel, he's an appointed official. So at any moment, Trump could say you're fired,
yeah.
Right? It's a big difference. But I think it is important to be transparent to the public when you're talking about a public official, not in an after action report, although that might have had less issues with this case. So let me make my point more clear because I'm not being clear. Tony, when you come out at the beginning of a case, in the middle of a case, and all of this comes to light, just think of what this has done when you talk about the adjudication of the case. The defense attorneys that are drooling to take this case because we're watching out publicly what Kash Patel is saying about the screw-ups in the case, right? If you don't have that, if Kash Patel doesn't say anything, if Nanos kept his mouth shut, you just have balls that were dropped that nobody's really going to know about. And my belief, you let everybody know about in the after action. You break it out publicly. Oh my gosh, it was 4 days. It went to the wrong lab. But to do it right now in an ongoing case, I think is more detrimental than the good it does. So that's my take on that.
How should Nanos be responding to this sort of criticism? When the interest ultimately for everybody here is finding Nancy Guthrie dead or alive at this point. But it seems to be we're playing more of a ping pong game of ego. It's not my problem. It's not my problem. If I did this, if I did that, it's rather than actually, hey, let's look at the ball here and look at the game and figure out what we need to do best. Not, you know, who's swinging something bigger. I mean, that seems to be what this is turning into more than the actual, you know, purpose of the game itself, of finding Nancy.
Well, you're right. I mean, when you look at mainstream media, even social media, even our podcasting, we now have, you know, at least 10 to 25% on Nanos and on the relationship with the FBI, because that is what's front and center, is how has an 84-year-old woman with the abductor on camera not been found?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
90 days in, almost 100, how has that happened? And so that's why you have media, social media, you and me and everybody else going, well, maybe we really need to look at this deeply. And we're seeing all these cracks within the decision-making early on. So I think that that's the genesis for why all of this started, like you said, that we're so off base in terms of Nancy becoming almost an afterthought to the focus right now. And it's really sad, but when you look at it, it's what are the investigators doing behind the scene? And they're still carrying on, no matter what we're talking about.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, no matter what the public-facing thing is, there are certainly the people on the ground are what matters more than anything else. But I mean, obviously, optics are extremely important. It just seems the folks in charge don't seem to grasp that concept very well. There's just there's so much to this that obviously feels like it could be done better. But here's where we're at right now, and you know, hoping for the best. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. Those links are in the description.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.